Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name's Barney Hoskins. I'm here with my colleague Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And we are going to be talking today extensively about Los Angeles. Everything is LA related this week. We're marking the 40th anniversary of the death of Lowell George. We're going to be hearing clips from an audio interview with the late Elliot Roberts. And we have a very special guest here today. Welcome, Chris Campion.
Thank you, Barney.
Who's come all the way from Pioneer Town, California, to join us to talk about Southern California. How's it being back in London after 5 years?
A little bit of a culture shock, you know, living in the desert for 5 years, pretty much.
You mean like a hermit in the desert?
Pretty much, sitting on top of a mountain, surrounded by coyotes and snakes. And
we have a picture on the homepage this week of you. I think, is that at the top of Cap Rock?
No, it's in the middle of Joshua Tree. It's actually at the location that Graham Parsons and Keith Richards went to Joshua Tree in 1968.
It's not the chair that they sat in.
It's not the actual chair, but somebody very kindly put another chair there just to mark the spot.
So Joshua Tree, it's become such a sort of holy kind of rock site, hasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it was in the USA Today a couple of years ago. They said it was in the top 10 locations for sort of music tourism, you know, along with Abbey Road and Graceland and, you know, various, you know, Hansa Studios or something like that. And Joshua Tree, because it's just got this incredible sort of mythology that goes along with it.
I've got to say that it's a long way from Bowie 3 to the Joshua Tree. And you wrote this piece, which is a terrific piece, Inside Grime for the Observer Music Monthly, back in 2004. And one paragraph caught my eyes. 10 minutes from here is the Crossways estate where Dizzy Rascal grew up. But in the 70s, and by the looks of it, left to decay ever since, Crossways is one of the most impoverished council estates in London, an unforgiving residential wasteland dominated by three 25-storey high-rises known locally as Three Flats. The long-deserted concrete playground outside has become a graveyard for discarded crack vials. All that's left of the swings is a skeletal carcass in its chipped metal frame. This made me roar with laughter. I lived on the Crossways estate for 15 years between 1980 and 1995. And it's not that bad. I mean,
maybe it just was the day that I went. I mean, I'm sure I didn't make it up, but
is that what you're suggesting?
I can't actually remember. I do have a vague memory of going there at this point. Because this article's, what, 2004, was it?
2004, yeah.
And it was, you know, I was sort of moving around East London. I was sort of
really
living in that area.
Improved by then. I mean, well, by sure that time, they're putting a concierge system, so there's a lot more security in the blocks. When I was there, anyone could walk in and out. We didn't have crack bars because crack hadn't really hit the place. But you'd walk down the stairs and you'd see the tin foil with burnt tin foil for people smoking heroin. But you know what? They were pretty good places to live. I love the idea that Dizzy Rascal was running around my knees, sort of by the lifts.
I do remember it being pretty raw looking. I mean,
it doesn't look beautiful. It's a brutalist bit of council estate building. But you know, council estates are like that. I mean, interestingly, I live now in a fairly gentrified bit of West London, and we had a crack house in our street, and that was much more terrifying than anything I had in the Crossways estate. Yeah, you know, it's just because they're vertical. You know, you just think that everything is just vertically terrible. Well, if it's a street, you think this is a perfectly pleasant street without realising kind of all the horrors. I just thought I'd put that in. That amused me enormously.
How do you get from writing about how do you get from grime to grime? What took you out to California in the first place and working for some years now on what I'm sure will be the definitive biography of the infamous John Phillips? How did you wind up?
I've been going out to California for quite a long time to do pieces every now and then, you know. But the John Phillips book is what really took me out there. I went out there and started doing interviews. Went out to Palm Springs, which was where John spent the last 7 or 8 years of his life, to meet his widow and his childhood friend when I started doing the book. And we ended up at the Joshua Tree Inn. So that was my first visit to Joshua Tree. Subsequent to that, everything that I've worked on for the past 7 or 8 years, while I've been working on the John Phillips book, I've been doing other projects. And I've just sort of followed these sort of little paths off, you know, something will catch my attention. And I'll go, oh, what's that? That's kind of interesting, and just start investigating that. So I ended up finding out about this sci-fi movie that Graham Parsons has shot in Joshua Tree in 1969, which you wrote about in Waiting for the Sun, I think, maybe?
I wrote about it in a big Graham Parsons piece.
Right,
yeah.
But that had only been written about, I think there was a couple of paragraphs about this thing, and I was like, well, you know, like Graham Parsons and UFOs, it's quite an odd sci-fi movie. And so I started investigating that, spent about a year interviewing people, found this fantastic story, and all these different characters like Nudie Cohn were involved, Michelle Phillips, Doug Trumbull, who had done the special effects on 2001. It was just a sort of fantastic thing. The movie was lost. There was a bunch of photos. You know, that sort of deepened my relationship to the area. And then I would find another story to work on that sort of was adjacent to that, and, you know, just sort of travelled on.
Really. And I both...
But John is the sort of, like, the lodestone, you know. Everything sort of came... Because he was such a fantastic character, and he knew so many different people and associated with so many different people that...
Absolutely. Because you and I both, and Mark, I think, as well, we're very interested in weird scenes inside the gold mine of Los Angeles and Southern California generally, aren't we? And in a way, it doesn't get any weirder or darker than in the life and music of John Phillips, especially considering, you know, he wrote the kind of siren song that brought so many people to California. I mean, California Dreaming was kind of like the invitation to come west, wasn't it?
Didn't he write that in New York?
It's an amazing
All
thing.
The leaves are brown.
It's an amazing story. It's him and Michelle were living in New York in the Albert Hotel, either the Albert or the Earl Hotel, and they were in a folk group at the time, and Michelle was sort of running off to have affairs with other people. I think she'd come back to New York, and it was the first time she'd ever seen snow. So they went out walking one day, and I think that night John was hopped up on speed or whatever it was, and he just started coming out with this song. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's the story of the walk that they did through New York that day. And it's quite an extraordinary thing for a song that conjures up all these ideas of the sort of bucolic California paradise to be really about New York and about dreaming of California. And it was Michelle dreaming of California, basically.
Well, recently, we put up that interview with Lou Adler, and he talked about auditioning them, and then was coming in and just opening their mouths and him being absolutely kind of dumbstruck by the noise that the mamas and papas made.
He says that, but I mean, but I've heard people say that he wasn't sure about them until Bones Howe, he asked, basically Bones Howe was in the studio, who was the engineer at Western, and also was the producer of The Turtles and The Fifth Dimension. At various times.
Absolutely.
And so apparently Lou turned to Bones and said, "What do you think?" And Bones said, "If you don't sign him, I will." And so Lou, being quite a competitive fellow, decided that it was probably a good idea to sign them.
And they were absolutely huge, the Mamas and the Papas, weren't they? I mean, they were part of what put Los Angeles on the map as a kind of pop capital in the 60s. And yet the story turns so sour and macabre, and we're right now in the summer of 2019, and of course Manson's in the air. You're sitting here with this new book, Chaos, by Tom O'Neill, which purports to be the sort of definitive Manson book, and Tarantino's new film is coming out. So how, Chris, did John Phillips in particular get from California Dreaming and the kind of golden innocence of that to being suspected by Roman Polanski of possibly having carried out these murders? I mean, what happens in those sort of three, four years?
I mean, I think they were all enjoying their lives a little bit too much.
Very succinctly put. So it's as simple as that, really.
Yeah, I mean, there was just a sort of derangement of the senses by everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know whether there's an argument to be made that they were all in such an altered state that they let the wolves come in the door or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, that kind of was what happened. You know, their defenses were all down.
Sure.
And to be fair, you know, Manson, John Phillips was one of the only people who really was just, I don't really want to, you know, Terry Melcher was approaching him and saying, "Do you want to record Manson?"
Yeah.
And he was like, "I don't really like the sound of this."
We posted an audio interview with Neil Young a couple of weeks ago, actually, very recently. And he talks about meeting Manson and being very impressed by him as a songwriter, as a singer. He said he could play the same song four different times and with completely different words each time. That he was actually Manson had a sort of touch of musical genius, but Neil Young also said that the hair stood up on the back of his neck and he just didn't want to be around the guy at all.
I mean, I would argue that his musical genius was on the level of Jandek, if you get the reference. I mean, it was, you know, it's very raw, sort of outsider.
Outsider raw,
And it's great. And that's the, you know, if you're listening to Manson, the Lie album, then that's the beauty of it, if you want to say that. But it is very creepy. And you know, the idea that the Beach Boys would promote him as the new signing to their label, and apparently did record an album. I've heard from somebody that there is a tape in the studio somewhere that's got Manson's name on it that the Beach Boys produced and Dennis Wilson and Melcher worked on. So
they notoriously more or less stole one of Manson's songs, didn't they? Well,
Dennis Wilson, I guess, put his name on it.
Didn't give him the credit, which,
you know, probably not a good idea if you got the homicidal maniacs.
Well, it ended up as Never Learn Not to Love.
Yeah, and it was Cease to Exist originally. Cease to Exist. Which is a much better title, obviously.
Great song. Actually, I mean, the way the Beach Boys did it, it was brilliant. So the three pieces that we've selected by you includes this epic piece you wrote about John Phillips for the Observer Music Monthly in the spring of 2009. And you inevitably, this is like a book proposal, you follow the story through into the 70s and just how, you talk about derangement of the senses, just how incredibly fucked up John Phillips was. And just an insane drug fiend. And he ends up sabotaging the biggest break of his kind of solo career when he's working not far from here, funnily enough. I went to see the movies at the Olympic Cinema on Friday night. So probably about 3 miles from here, he's working with Keith Richards. They're both absolutely, completely fucked up on heroin. Mm-hmm. And this album only comes out years later, doesn't it? I actually listened to it this morning. I mean, it's in places very Stonesy. Jagger's singing here and there. Keith's playing some pretty cool kind of Keith licks. But I mean, it's not a great album.
I don't know, man. I'd argue against that. Okay. I mean, I think
it's better than you might think, isn't it?
It's a great album. Look, it was John Phillips with the Stones as his backing band. Charlie wasn't on it, but Ronnie was on it. Mick Taylor was on it.
Yeah.
Is that the album we were listening to yesterday?
No, we were actually listening to something else and agreeing that, you know, Phillips was not a great singer, sort of wannabe Graham in a way. I mean, I think both he and Terry Melcher, both sort of very deeply aspired to sort of being Graham Parsons in a way. They were very, very smitten with Graham.
I mean, I was going to mention the Terry Melcher album's fantastic, you know? I mean, that's one of my favourite albums.
Would you really make that argument?
Yeah, I love it.
You do really like it? Okay.
Yeah,
it's not
fantastic.
As good as GP, though.
No, but, you know,
anyway,
you know, it depends where you're going to rate them.
But look, it is such an extraordinary story.
But yeah, so basically John, at that point, he's recording with the Stones. I think Armut Ertegun's given him this incredible record deal, and Mick and Keith are producing, and it just all goes exactly where you think it will go. Yeah. You know, Keith actually had just been busted in Toronto while they're recording that record. They started off in London, and then they moved to New York, and then Keith gets busted. And although the official history is that he was clean and he'd sort of sorted himself out, that's not, you know, what I've heard. You know, I think he was having his last hurrah before facing the music.
Well, you talk to the engineer and it's this, and he says, you know, every time either of them went into the bathroom at Olympic, we thought they wouldn't come out. You know, we'd find them dead in there. I mean, but you go through so many extraordinary things. I'm sure your book is going to go into such detail about the man who fell to Earth he's involved with. There's the space musical that was a disaster in New York. And then he ends up on Mystique singing with Princess Margaret. I mean, it's such a... It's got to be a movie, hasn't it? Have you optioned the rights?
Not yet, but, you know...
And then Genevieve Waite as well. I mean, that album's died last month, very recently.
Yeah, and then Genevieve Waite is one of this... It's just an extraordinary sort of record. 40s Fantasia big band
Romance
record
on the
slash road. Disco, you know, in the disco era. Meet Mr. Blue, elegant Jew of New York City. John basically decided he wanted to make her into a star, wrote all these amazing songs for her, and she co-wrote a few of them. And, you know, the one problem was that Genevieve couldn't sing. So But Genevieve had the most amazing voice, which has been described as Betty Boop meets Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Most memorably, I think.
Yes.
And I've heard tapes. I've actually heard the raw tapes, 45 takes, one syllable at a time.
As, oh, really?
As he, you know, basically trained her to, you know, sing the songs. And she obviously got it in the end. There's a few points on the album where she's like, so far off, she's yeah. never going to get back on track again.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful record, and it's you know, a lot of the time with John Phillips, the business side of things just sort of, you know, destroyed any ambitions he had, and all of these great projects. Unlike a lot of his peers, he was never on a record label for, you know, more than a few years. He didn't have, say, you know, Dylan's relationship with Columbia or Neil Young's relationship with Reprise. He didn't have a manager. You know, he was doing it all himself. It's an amazing thing to think about at that time. One of those artists, you know, they all had managers. They all had record labels.
Yeah.
And he was really going out there and sort of trying to do it all on his own and sort of getting in bed with sort of dodgy businessmen and people who didn't necessarily have his best interests at heart. And that's what makes it interesting in some ways, his sort of perilous path that he negotiated through popular culture, meeting all these amazing people. I mean, he hung out with John Paul Getty Jr. He hung out with Robert Kennedy Jr. He hung out with Peter Lawford. I mean, there's endless amounts of it. And I think, you know, a lot of the time, because of the dynamism of his personality, he was able to, you know, move into all these worlds that other people wouldn't necessarily have been able to. So, definitely,
you know, I'm reminded of a lunch I had with the late, great, absolutely delightful man, David Anderley, who was a Beach Boys acolyte and also worked at Elektra.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him saying to me, you know, all these people, you know, the Grahams, the Arthur Lees, the John Phillipses, the Neil Youngs, you know, even the Phil Spectors, they're all quite dark and quite sort of haunted souls. I can't remember the exact expression he used. And that leads me to the next piece of yours, which is an interview you did with Arthur Lee in 2002, so not long before, like 7 years before the John Phillips piece. I mean, Arthur Lee, Forever Changes, some people would say it's like a sort of harbinger of the darkness that was about to sort of unfold with Manson, etc.
Mm-hmm.
We'd probably agree it's one of the great records ever to come out of Los Angeles.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did you find Arthur?
Well, he insisted on running, I think, maybe at least one, possibly two tape recorders while we were talking. So, you know, he wanted his own version of whatever we were talking about. I think he had someone filming it and a tape recorder. I don't think he was long out of prison at that
time. No, when you say he wasn't long out of prison.
And he was not long out of prison, and then suddenly his career had just sort of taken off again, because I think it was the trip that he made to London to perform at the Royal Festival Hall, or the Queen Elizabeth Hall, or whichever one it was. You know, he was a prickly character. You've met him, but you met him probably not at his best.
He'd already had five Bloody Marys when I sat down with him.
I've heard horror stories about that.
That's the one where he basically says that he and Jimi Hendrix had a sexual relationship.
He claims that Jimi came on to him in a threesome. He's in bed with Jimi and a girl, and Jimi started coming on to him. I mean, he was almost convincing. I didn't really know. It seemed unlikely. But the spirit of the times, anything could happen in Los Angeles, right?
Right. But yeah, he was a prickly character. But again, he's another one of these characters that just sort of wandered through. Personally, I love Forever Changes, but I love the records that came afterwards. I think For Sale's a fantastic record. I mean, that's an amazing band. If you see the footage of them on, you know, there's some Dutch footage.
I first read about them, Zigzag magazine. They were the first people to really still talk about them in this country.
They were obsessed with Arthur Lee.
And they talked about this notorious interview where this woman journalist is basically kind of trapped in the mansion up in the Hollywood Hills.
The castle,
And we've got that interview, because she's one of our writers, Rochelle Reed.
Mm.
We got it from KRLA Beat, and she writes it up. She's trying to be as polite as possible about a really unpleasant experience.
Yeah.
And this is like 67, something like that, so, you know, 2 years before Charlie Manson's made his appearance.
There was something creepy about love, there's no doubt about it, and they flirted with the dark side. And there are moments on Forever Changes that are kind of chilling. Chillingly beautiful.
Well, I mean, I love that, you know, the snot has caked against my pants.
Yeah.
It's one of the greatest opening lines of any
song.
The
Red Telephone has to be one of the sort of scariest LA songs that I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, I remember him, there was one thing where he was talking in the interview about sitting on a hill
Yeah.
Oh, it was
sitting on a hill.
Watching all the people die, you know. Yeah.
Sitting on a hill side, watching all the people die. I'll feel much better on the other side.
He really didn't think that he was going to last very long, no. I think. And he felt this sense of, you know, just this dread,
yes,
coming down the canyons, I guess, you know, and that you know, it was definitely a precursor of what was going on at the time. You know, you have to remember, I did a lot of research into Monterey Pop while I was doing the John Phillips book.
Course.
I wrote this long chapter about it, and the whole idea of the Summer of Love is this wonderful season of
goodwill.
Well-being and goodwill, yes. Is absolute rubbish, yeah. Because San Francisco was a nightmare at the time. There was speed.
Yeah. It was the Wild West.
There was like Hell's Angels. Yeah. There was, you know.
I mean, the hippies themselves held the funeral for the hippie in the middle of the Summer of Love.
Right.
And with the exception of the Airplane, who kept their house just off 8th Street, everyone else was bailing out. If they could move out to Nevada, if they could move out to Marin County,
yeah,
they were getting out because San Francisco itself was becoming a hellhole.
Yeah, I mean, if you read Joan Didion, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, she captures that because she was there at that time.
Yeah.
And she really does report, and she talks about the kids as, like, just really having no clue what they were doing.
Well, of course, Charlie Manson had just come out of jail. He ended up on Haight-Ashbury.
That was his...
Before he went down to LA, that's where he was.
But this is where he developed his whole shtick and started kind of recruiting people and sort of doing all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I mean, Monterey itself was actually the only event that personified the Summer of Love, because
it was downhill all the way after that, really.
Well, but also famously, you know, I mean, the city of Monterey were just petrified of the fact that they had a venue which really held, I think, 6,000 or 8,000
people.
Yeah, it's
very small.
Very, very small. And if you go there, I went to the Monterey...
The showgrounds.
And I was just like, wow, this, like, you know, I'd seen the film and everything, and you just don't realise how small it is, you know? And they were petrified of, like, 300,000 kids coming down there and swamping the town by, you know, doubling the population, tripling the population. And the Hell's Angels were coming down because the dead wanted the Hell's Angels there. And remarkably, there was not one single arrest that weekend. So, you know, in some ways, John Phillips and Lou Adler pulled off the impossible, managed to create an event that was peace, love, and flowers and music. And, you know, you look at what happened at the other festivals. We're in the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, which was just absolutely shambolic and a nightmare. And then Altamont, which was exactly the same.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Let's fast forward to Devendra Banhart, only in the sense that it interests me that what happens in California, particularly in the late 60s and the early 70s, has become such a sort of lodestone, such a reference point for so many like bands, so much pop culture stuff going on in cinema, and it's like some people want to go back to that time. They want to go back and somehow kind of live in Laurel Canyon in 1969 or whatever the hell it is. Devendra Banhart, who you interviewed, I think, probably in Topanga Canyon, where he was living, exemplified that. So this is 2007, this interview with him, and his album was just come out called Smokey Rolls Down Thunder Canyon. Did you just, my question really be, did it feel like just very sort of retro and very, yeah, just too referencing of that time? Or did you feel that people like Banhart, you also mentioned Joanna Newsom, all people that connection, did you feel he was doing something convincingly new with his reference points?
I mean, I wasn't particularly convinced by him before I met him or after.
There's something a bit Manson-esque about
him. I was going to say, I mean, there is something a little like that. And,
like a guru.
Well, I mean, I remember he was very much wanted to, you know, draw me in, and was kind of very, you know, well, maybe, I don't know. But I mean, I remember we went into the bedroom and his guru, the photo of his guru was on the wall, you know, I mean, because he'd grown up in a religious cult. And, you know, was still, I think it was the same guru. It was like an Indian guru. I can't remember the name. I might have mentioned it in the piece.
You do.
So, yeah, there was that sort of vibe there. And I was never really that convinced by him. I mean, he's still making music. And but, you know, I guess that whole era, when was this? Was it late 90s when he started coming out?
Yes.
Was it a little bit later on?
I can't remember when it was early 2000s. But no, he was making music in the late 90s, for
sure. But a lot of that sort of generation of new singer-songwriters were obviously drawing from the Laurel Canyon era, you know, whether you talking about, you know, Joanna or Entrance, Guy Blakeslee's, like, Entrance and Devendra Banhart were sort of matched quite a lot at that time. And I was much more a fan of Guy because he just seemed a lot grittier and you know, a lot more talented as a songwriter. And he still is, because he brought out an album a couple of years ago that was just phenomenal.
What your piece reminded me of was that he had recently started being managed by Elliot Roberts.
Right.
Neil Young's longtime manager and Joni Mitchell's original manager.
And I think he's still on Reprise, or he was at
the
time.
He may well be.
So he was really definitely, you know, there was a conscious attempt to sort of mould him in that sort of Neil Young kind of image, you know.
Absolutely. I think Elliot
and Topanga Canyon, where Neil was living, I think.
That's right. So it, everything was sort of coming around again, wasn't it? Everybody knows. So we've just lost Elliot Roberts, who was sort of David Geffen's partner in that management stable on Asylum Records, and they really sort of sewed up that kind of West Coast scene in the early 70s. And I interviewed Elliot in 1993, and we're going to hear a clip from that interview where he talks...
He talks about how the scene in the canyons, and specifically Joni Mitchell's house, where everyone would march into through her house to swap guitars.
Yeah.
That's what you did with your nights, you know, you go around to different clubs or sessions, and everyone was always welcomed at every session. And, you know, we would be at Joni's house 6 nights a week from 2 to about 5 in the morning. Yeah. It would be Jackson and Tim Hardin and Leonard Cohen and Judy Collins, and every folky in town every night would come by, and we'd do the clubs. And then, you know, we'd stop at Joni's for a drink, and then everyone would start passing guitars around, and it was really like that.
Yes.
Exactly. And, you know, now, you know, it's just not like that, unfortunately. It's a lot more competitive for the, I guess, for the buck.
It's just a bigger business.
It's just a whole other scene, yeah. And it really is a bigger business.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot.
Yeah, so Elliot comes to Los Angeles with Joan, as he calls her.
Yes.
I like that. Yeah. Joan. It's always Joan. Of course, is actually her real name. And that's sort of the original, that's the kind of birth of that scene, really.
He's very interesting. Essentially, they meet David Crosby, and David Crosby just left the Byrds. But everything kind of revolved around David Crosby. He was the great scenester. And David Crosby then is going to produce Jonah's first album, and they're in the studio next door, Buffalo Springfield. Joni Mitchell says, you've got to come and meet Neil, the old buddies from Toronto. And it just, everything sort of
unfolds from there.
And this interview is fascinating. He also talks, this is a really great bit about, he really wants to manage Buffalo Springfield. And he goes along to the rehearsal room. And basically, Neil Young tells him to fuck off. You know, we don't want to work with you, get out. He was living with Neil at the time. He packs his bags, find somewhere else to stay. And like 2 weeks later, Neil's knocking on his door saying, manage me, man. He says, what do you mean? You know, you just told me, I didn't want you to manage the band. I want you to manage me.
He's a Machiavellian motherfucker, that Neil Young, isn't he?
But it's a fantastic moment in this very, very interesting interview.
He managed Neil pretty much to his dying day. At least kind of nominally, he was still Neil's manager as of like last Saturday.
Yeah. I mean, he's very nice about David Geffen, who generally is less nice about him in return, from what I understand. He says, you know, he's saying in this interview, oh, we know we're still good friends, but he understood that David was, we'll talk about David a little bit later as well, but that Geffen was fiercely ambitious. He really wanted to run Warner Brothers, and when he couldn't do that, he set up Asylum, effectively, for intensive.
Geffen Roberts was a great double act in that Geffen just had a sort of fearsome business brain. I mean, he could just out-think and out-maneuver anybody. Whereas Elliot was more the people person. And that's what so many people told me. It's like, Geffen would be on the phone to Ahmet Ertegun at like midnight. And by then, Elliot had already driven around every one of his artists in the canyon just to smoke a joint and see how they were doing and how the new songs were coming along. And so it was a really good kind of symbiosis.
He also kind of, I mean, his passion is songwriters, actually. Almost more than anything else, like songwriters. But then he becomes aware that the scene is changing, and particularly in terms of the Eagles. But in fact, let's play this clip of him talking about the Eagles and about how the way they wrote songs was for the intention of having hit records rather than just writing great songs.
Could you have foreseen that they would go from like being around the Troubadour in 69 to something like Stadium?
The Eagles are different.
Right. Because they were...
We did know.
They crossed into pop. But were they always going
to
do that?
Yes, they were made to do that.
Right.
That's different. I mean, they were Linda Ronstadt's band.
Yes.
They were a unit that David and I knew real well. Bernie put them, for the most part, together.
Right.
It wasn't Don and Glenn. Right, it was more Bernie.
Yes.
And, but...
did they know they always wanted to be huge?
Yes, because that's what they wrote for.
Right.
They wrote to be... I mean, they were different kinds of songwriters.
Right.
You'd sit in a room with Don, Glenn, and J.D. Souther, and they'd come up with three songs.
Mm.
That, you know, they're Neil or Joan go, you know, right. You'll be talking to them and you'll realize they're writing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can't say on Monday, I need a song by Wednesday.
Right.
You can with Eagles. As soon as you stop interrupting.
Yeah, that brings back the memories of Elliot's kids by his second marriage.
You know, the interesting thing about that is, well, I didn't know that Bernie Leadon was the one who put the Eagles together, but obviously that relates back to Graham and the Flying Burrito Brothers, obviously.
Very much so.
At whose knees, essentially, the Eagles learned, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And in a way, they learned what not to do. I mean, you know, Don Henley and Glenn Frey would go and watch the Burritos and then watch Graham solo, and were completely inspired by what he was doing with country rock, but they also saw how untogether he was and hedonistic he was, and they were like, we're going to do this properly, we're going to write hit records, we want hit records. And Graham wasn't interested in hit records. The Eagles thought we actually could have hits with these songs. But it's still an incredible stretch to think about these sort of, you know, these long-haired guys hanging around in denim jeans in the Troubadour, that these guys were going to become the biggest band in America.
It's got to be remembered that actually Linda Ronstadt broke through first in terms of really big selling.
Sure.
And they were heavily associated with her, so they're obviously watching that as well.
Absolutely.
Having been her backing
band. Very good point.
Anyway, we're going to play another clip at the end of the show, but it's a really, really interesting interview, and you know, here we are in Los Angeles for the day, you know.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I mean, Neil came out after Elliot died the other day and said, you know, he was the greatest manager that ever was. And, you know, what I'll remember is this guy who sort of, when he came to LA, he looked like kind of Woody Allen. He was just this guy growing up in the Bronx, Elliot Rabinowitz, you know, and he comes to California, and the guy I met was this sort of completely sort of zen, suntanned, like long-haired Californian dude.
You say that, but if you don't see him, you listen to the tape, he is still the guy from the Bronx.
Of course, you can't take the guy out of the Bronx.
He's still got that sort of slight energy and that sort of New York twang and everything like that. You know, so if you can't see his tan, if you can't see his long hair, you're listening to a guy out of the Bronx. It's great.
But I mean, you know, without him, you know, Joni wouldn't have signed to Reprise, Neil wouldn't have signed to Reprise, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young probably wouldn't have happened. Yeah. The Eagles might not have happened. Geffen might not have come to LA. You know, we've lost a very important and beloved character. You know, definitely, as you say, much more loved than Geffen.
Who we'll get onto in a little bit.
So from there, we're just going to sidestep into Lowell George, who was also on Warner Brothers and part of that stable to some extent. But 40 years since Lowell died, you and I, we're massive Little Feet fans.
Huge.
I saw them in 74. 5 at the Rainbow.
I will envy you for that forever.
That's fine by me. You know, I live to be envied. But I did go January 75 to the Rainbow. And me and my little buddies, we had fallen in love with Little Feet. And you know, the story is that the headline act was the Doobie Brothers. And already by this point, the Doobie Brothers were just not cool. So everybody went to... all the entire pub rock community in London went to see Little Feet because Lowell was like God.
Mm.
And then the moment the Doobies came out, half the crowd walked out, and I bet Elvis Costello was one of them. But they were fabulous. They were sort of unique because they were the opposite of like the Eagles. They drew on so many different influences: hard Chicago blues, funk. So
the New Orleans R&B. New Orleans.
Well, so the first piece we've got is 73, and it's David Ranson of Crawdaddy talking to Lowell just after Dixie Chicken's come.
Which is when those two guys had joined the band: the bass player Sam Clayton, and
Kenny Gradney.
And the whole band sort of shifted gear in terms of its rhythmic centre and so on. So
yes.
It's funny, I mean, I don't think they ever made a single really great album with the possible exception of Sailing Shoes. Mm. There were too many disparate forces in that band. They tend to pull in too many different directions to really, like, make the great album that I think they were capable of.
But a greatest hits album is one of the greatest records ever made.
Fantastic. You,
I mean, we've actually put together a playlist for Spotify, and I would say that there are kind of 20 songs there that put Lowell, you know, in the very elite.
I also really liked his solo album, which got very bad press at the time. We got a bunch of reviews on the site of Thanks, I'll Eat It Here, all of which were expressing some huge disappointment. It wasn't the great Lowell George solo album. But actually, it's a pretty damn good record.
It's still a good record, isn't it?
There's something really sweet about Lowell as well. I mean, you know, in 1977 when they played here, not good shows by a number of accounts.
Well, the second piece is by Max Bell and NME, and it is very, very candid about the unhappiness in the camp.
That's from 77, yeah.
That Lowell has already essentially stepped outside of the...
You saw an interesting incident on stage.
Well, I know, as Max says, and he says in the piece, and he's only going by what he can kind of deduce from looking at Lowell's lips, that Billy Payne, the sometimes reviled keyboard player who really wanted to be Joe Zawinul. So on Dixie Chicken on the Hammersmith Odeon stage, he starts playing a solo, and Max thinks that Lowell wanders over and says, "Play some fucking rock and roll for Christ's sakes." And it wouldn't surprise you.
A friend of mine was working at the Hard Rock Cafe at the time, and on one of those nights late, the whole band had come to the Hard Rock Cafe for American food, you know. And apparently Lowell is standing up the street weeping, saying, "This is all shit, I can't stand this anymore."
Yeah.
You know, 77, he was a year away from leaving the band, was he, 70?
So 78, 79, yeah. I mean, the solo album comes out in 79. And the last piece we have is the last interview he ever gave. In Boston, Jim Sullivan and his friend Dean Johnson interview Lowell for a little kind of local rag called Sweet Potato. And, you know, it's just extraordinary to read, and two weeks later he's dead.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's a sort of basically with a cocaine-induced heart attack.
Cocaine and being massively overweight. Yeah. Those two things don't normally go hand in hand, but in Lowell's case, for some reason, they did. Whether he was drinking a lot as well, I suspect he probably was. I think Remy Martin was his tipple of choice. I mean,
takes us back to John Phillips, who wasn't overweight, but
well, absolutely.
Certainly liked his cocaine.
I mean, I think the thing that these guys have in common is that they weren't just sort of cool rock stars. They were really quite interesting, eclectic, thoughtful people, however fucked up they were. I mean, Lowell was a really interesting, like, bohemian kid in Hollywood High School. Everybody says, I mean, Lowell was just so different.
Mm.
And I think you'd probably say the same of John Phillips, say the same of Arthur Lee. They all had brains.
Right.
And I don't know whether Lowell ever had anything to do with John Phillips. Little Feet mean anything to you?
Not really.
I think you should, do some investigation.
I will. I will, absolutely.
I do think they were one of the great West Coast bands. I think anyone who really loved blues, soul, funk in LA, who wanted something different from the sort of soft or yacht rock elite, gravitated to Little Feat. And I think it was one of the great heartbreaks for Warner Reprise that Little Feat didn't become the huge kind of American Stones almost that, that they should have been in many ways.
But, you know, I mean, this is a problem if you have a band where, in fact, there's one guy who really writes good songs, but there are three other guys who think they can write songs and had to be accommodated, which is why none of their albums are completely
and
good.
Lowell probably wasn't strong enough to stand up to them and say, do you know what, essentially this is my band.
Well, there's also this notion of band being democracy. Now, bands aren't democracies. Bands never can be democracies.
No.
Yet, Little Feat's attempt to be democratic, and it was a disaster for them.
So we can go from here back to David Geffen, can't we?
We're going to go through what's new in the library. Well, no, we're going to go back further than that first. We're going to start off in 64. There's a piece on Rave on the Stones where they basically talk to all the people around the Stones. And you know, the Stones were just making it. They had their second hit. And they get Keith's mother, and she's just brilliant. She says, like, you know, it cost me about £1 a day to keep Keith going, and of course I never got a penny back. I sent Keith cash whenever I could, and food parcels too, because I knew the money would just go on cigarettes instead of a good solid meal.
That is hysterical.
The shirts they used to send me to wash for them looked as though they'd been buried for a fortnight. I just love this, because, I mean, I don't think I've ever read her quoted anywhere else. And this
I love the idea that 1964, the money would just go on cigarettes.
That's what he was telling his mum.
Well, it's a jazz cigarette.
Jazz wood bomb.
66 record Mirror, Richard Greene interviews Rick Gunnell. Rick Gunnell's a really fascinating person. He and Georgia Gomelsky were the management / promoter figures behind the British blues boom, essentially. This is very much about Georgie Fame, who's his big star at the moment. But in 66, he's already managing John Mayall, for example. Yeah. He gets a mixed press these days that, you know, he was a difficult businessman, he ripped people off and all that. But, I mean, he ran a Flamingo, you know, without people like Rick Gunnell, the British blues boom probably would never have got legs.
Well, without gangsters, there would be no music scene anywhere ever, would there, really?
Absolutely. Jimi Hendrix at the Bag O' Nails, January 67. And this is really about all the people. This is quite an important gig. The Blazers and Bag O' Nails shows were the ones where Jimi Hendrix really blew London away, where suddenly, as it says here, Bill Wyman, Paul McCartney, Donovan, Keith Moon, Brian Epstein, Viv Prince, Tony Booth, Georgie Fame, Twiggy, Eric Clapton, Pete Townsend, Liza Minnelli were all there at the Bag O' Nails to see Jimi Hendrix experience, which sort of gives you an idea of the impact this guy had just had. He'd only been in the country, 3 months by that point?
It's one of my, I mean, if I can just interject, one of my very favourite pieces that I've worked on over the past few years was to interview one of Jimi Hendrix's girlfriends, who was sort of had been long forgotten. She was called Lithophane Pridgen.
Oh, I remember that piece.
Yes, yes.
And she, you know, she told me...
Is she Dolly Dagger? No, that's...
No, she's... I realised while I was working on the piece that she's Foxy Lady. And, there's no independent evidence to prove that, but the things that she was telling me married so perfectly with the lyrics. But Lithophane grew up in the Deep South in the 40s, went to New York, Harlem with Little Willie John, who was her first kind of major boyfriend.
Okay.
Met Sam Cooke, became a lover of Sam Cooke. Eventually met Jimi Hendrix at an orgy in New York.
As you do. We met at an orgy.
And from 1962 or 1963, she was associated with Hendrix all the way through to 1970.
Right, so but way the before the girls we know about.
Yeah. And she's, you know, currently, I would say, she's the only person left alive who knows Jimi, you know, as well, you know, but she knew Jimi better than anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, Billy Cox is still alive, but I mean, I think Lithophane, you know, just had this very, you know, intense, intimate relationship with him over the years. But to talk about the impact of those Bag O' Nails shows, you know, and from what he was coming from, because she's told me they were basically living in poverty, in Harlem.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd moved down to Greenwich Village and, you know, basically met Chaz Chandler. Yeah. And then suddenly just took off like a rocket as soon as he came to the UK. But it's a pretty amazing story. And it you know, goes back to the Mamas and the Papas, who had a similar story, ended up in LA, you know, drove across the States, absolutely poverty-stricken. Suddenly,
like
within
Beverly
Hillbillies, and 6 months, they're biggest rock stars on the planet.
And to tie it up further, it's Paul McCartney recommends to John Phillips that Jimi Hendrix play at the Monterey Pop Festival.
And that's how Jimi Hendrix was launched in America basically.
It's such a sort of you know, small community in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
This sort of triangulation of London, New York, and Los Angeles was really the sort of fomented everything.
And I don't think that, I mean, weirdly, although the world has got smaller, supposedly, you know, I mean, I don't think those kind of things would happen in the same way.
No.
Which, in fact, Elliot Robertson, in the interview, talks about exactly that, about everything becomes more fractured and more separated and so on and so forth. But
the list of people in that piece about the Bagnells is, I mean, it's literally every mover and shaker and glamour puss in London is there.
It's absolutely extraordinary.
In January 67, they are all there in this one subterranean club.
Tiny club.
Well, you wouldn't have, you know, I mean, you'd love to have been in that place, wouldn't it?
When we had Dawn James on in your seat 2 or 3 weeks back, and she talked about, she wrote for Rave at that time, she talked about it being a tiny scene. Everyone knew everyone else, you know.
Including journalists. They were much more kind of embedded in the
Right, there weren't the barriers.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get to David Geffen, Roy Carr interview from 72. Geffen's pretty much just set up Asylum. Asylum's a pretty new label in 72. Very much for the expressing of working with Joni and so on and so forth. He also was very involved in Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and he's asked a lot about them because they were at that point still regarded as the biggest item that he owned, in a manner of speaking. And he's marvellously rude. He says, Graham was very laid back and extremely quiet, modest gentleman. Then there's Stephen, who, as you know, is not particularly modest about anything. Basically, this was the point that Neil talked about in the audio interview before, that, you know, people who will work with someone and not work with other people. David has said some very outrageous things in concert about Nixon, but I don't think Nixon cares very much. He probably doesn't know who David Crosby is.
Unlikely.
It's a very interesting interview because, I mean, you get this sense of his concentration. Mm. You know, this is a man who's absolutely focused on what he needs to do to get his acts across and so on and so forth. Mm. You know, there's no sentimentality in this at all. Mm. Unlike, let's say, listening to the Elliot Roberts interview, where this is a man who just loves his artists. You don't really get the feeling from David that he does, but only insofar as they're a means to some sort of greater end.
I think he did love some of his artists. He was genuine. You have to remember that before he came to LA, at sort of the behest of Elliot Roberts, you know, come and help me, David, do these deals, because I don't know how to do deals. Mm-hmm. Geffen had already, like, musically fallen in love with Laura Nyro.
Well,
and I mean, and I think had a relationship with her at a time when he was still trying to kind of convince himself, or at least his mother, that he was heterosexual. So he was overawed by Laura Nyro, and who wouldn't be? I'm a massive Nyro fan.
It's a very interesting piece, and it's pure coincidence. I proofread this last week before Elliot Roberts died. We ended up with them both featuring on the site.
Absolutely.
Moving forward to May 76, a reader's letter to the NME about a fracas or a Sex Pistols show at Nashville, and the reader happens to be Neil Tennant, future smash hits writer and then Pet Shop Boy. And it's marvellously catty stuff. I mean, one of the lines is, one of their coterie of fag hags picks a fight with the girl seated next to her. I mean, coterie of fag hags, you know. Wow.
Coming from Neil.
So it's basically the NME reprinted this letter. I think it must have caught someone's eye, because within about a year he was on the sort of founding team on sort of smash hits or so. Anyway, it's great. Melody Maker 78, Ian Birch interview with Talking Heads. They'd just worked with Eno for the first time.
More songs about building food was the first one he did.
Ian Birch says, Eno would be the first person to admit that he's not a virtuoso in the sense that he plays a really boss guitar or mean piano. I just love the idea of him using the term boss guitar or mean piano adjacent to Eno in the paragraph.
Yeah, it doesn't really go with Brian Eno, does it?
Yeah. I think also that we never feared, like some people in the record company did, that we were going to be Eno-ized. And there's a nice line from Dave Byrne saying, it could seem very contrived, but I think that's the way people are now. The days of naive, primitive rock bands are gone. Mm. Well, they keep coming back, don't they?
Mm.
Spin 1988, Holly Gleason talking to Merle Haggard, the great Merle Haggard. And he's a couple of things, great things here. He says, the Bakersfield sound never was as country as the Nashville sound. It's always been rockabilly. That's what it is. Which is actually a fair point, that the Bakersfield sound is very much a kind of amped up bar band version of country. And he says, talking about Okie from Muskogee and the notoriety that surrounded that song, he says, I didn't give a shit how long their hair was, but the fact that the ones with long hair were the ones burning the damn flag, I didn't like it. I still don't.
On the subject of Merle Haggard, have you explored that kind of connection from between sort of Gram Parsons and Bakersfield and Merle Haggard? Are you interested in that?
I mean, I know, you know, Gram was trying to get Merle to produce his solo.
That's correct.
Wasn't he? And you know, Gram was very much enthralled to the Bakersfield sound.
Yeah.
And also, Keith really credits Gram with teaching him the difference between the Bakersfield sound and what they were doing in Nashville and the chord progressions and things like that. So,
absolutely.
You know, and that's what led to Wild Horses, according to legend.
Absolutely. You know?
Which Gram probably had a little bit more hand in than anyone wants to admit, because it sounds almost like a Gram Parsons song more than a Stones song.
Well, also, that's what the Stones did. They just stole from the people around them.
And, you know, and also the Flying Burrito Brothers really, I think, I feel, did the definitive version of it, and they recorded it first, obviously, as well. So
I think Graham actually did go and spend the weekend Shay Haggard. They just to sort of see whether they could get along. And
weirdly,
Mar was fairly appalled by this, this kind of, fairly
and then he actually
then
he wanted John Phillips to produce his album, I think, and then that didn't happen. And then he ended up with Terry Melcher post Manson Murders, and they were both an absolute mess. And those sessions. They did record, but those were apparently, you know, liberated from the A&M archives and never been heard of since. So.
I think I'm right in saying that Gram and John Phillips were on motorbikes going through Bel Air and had an accident.
Right.
I think Gram was the one who came off the worst. But so they
only Gram was the only one who came off. I mean, he came off his bike. He had a Harley that obviously he bought because he was fairly wealthy.
Yes.
And he jerry-rigged it with a coat hanger through the front end, and the entire thing broke, and he, you know, was left in the middle of the street with, I think Genevieve told me, blood pumping out of him. And I actually think that sort of was what hastened the end of you know, it definitely hastened the end of Graham's career with the Flying Burrito Brothers, because he was hopped up on pain pills for a long time. He was really banged up.
He became very bloated.
And I mean, he was hopped up on pain pills, and then the Burritos were going on tour for their second album, probably the second album, and he did not like flying anyway. Mm. So I think at that point, Chris Hillman really had enough of him. He was just kind of a mess. And that was when he was fired. So,
well, I'm so staying in the Los Angeles vibe. Musician 1994, Mark Rowland interviewing Lenny Waronko, who's one of the great record men at Warner Brothers. The irony of this interview came out in, I think it's July 1994. It's therefore the interview was probably taped in late June, maybe early July. Within about 6 weeks, Waronko was off the label. That Mo Austin had been fired. They offered him Mo Austin's job. He didn't want anything to do with what people described as know-nothing bean counters. And he left, and kind of with Mo Austin at DreamWorks, did the whole thing all over again, this idea of creating a place where artists can make the records they want and the record company would support them. So it's a very good interview. I love this line. He says, "You know, there is a method behind all this lofty artistic bullshit. If you aligned yourself with that, there would be a payoff." I mean, the idea being, if you gave people the time, you gave them space, that at some stage or another, people start buying their records and recognise the quality. Not always, but enough to justify.
Well, that was the extraordinary thing about Warner Brothers, wasn't it? Because they did sign a bunch of particularly singer-songwriters who no one would have said, well, these guys are going to be big pop stars. Joni wasn't going to be a huge pop star. Randy Newman wasn't going to be a huge pop star. But they built a kind of base there, which in turn attracted so many million-selling acts to Burbank, including the thing I picked out was about Prince. You know, Prince comes to Warner Brothers, and Mark Rowland asks Waronko in this interview about Prince, and just fascinating stuff about, he's 17 years old, and he sort of auditions for Lenny and Mo and Russ Titelman, and they're all just utterly blown away, because this kid just comes in, lays down about 7 tracks,
puts down a guitar,
all the
part,
instruments,
puts down a drum part
in like 2 hours, and they're just like, sign this guy. There's something really interesting though that I've never heard this before. Waronko says that Prince sidled up to him one day and said, "Lenny, don't make me into a black artist. I like the Beatles, I like Jimi Hendrix, I like it all."
Mm-hmm.
And Lenny says, "It stunned me." So we knew he was very fixed in what he wanted to do. There was an enormous amount of talent there. We didn't know, none of us knew where he was going.
Yeah.
But the idea that already, at like 17, it's hard to believe, he didn't want to be presented by Warners as an R&B act.
Yeah. I mean, everything about the way in which it's obviously that relationship fell to pieces later between Warners and Prince.
Of course.
But the idea that any label would give a guy with no track record whatsoever outside some word of mouth in Minneapolis total artistic control of his records from the very word go is unheard of.
Yeah, they did bring in this guy Tommy Vicari, who was just sort of notionally the overseeing producer, but essentially it was just like they, you know, I think Lenny and the others felt they just needed a paternal hand on his shoulder, but essentially he was doing everything himself from the word go.
And then, sort of 4 years later, George Michael gets arrested in a gentleman's lavatory in a park in Los Angeles. We're staying in Los Angeles. And Barbara Ellen writes a marvellously kind of catty piece about this the week after it happened. Her sort of shtick is that he was where he was because he'd never come out. That if he'd come out years before, none of these things would be an issue. And she says, and while for many in the gay community, socialising in a public lavatory would be classed as routine, for a personality like Michael, it undoubtedly is not. The most circumspect and cagey of men, he's never come across as a sexual exhibitionist. On the contrary, he has rather given the impression he takes baths with his underpants on. That's Barbara Ellen, sort of, you know. But it's an interesting piece. She's critical of him whilst also being enormously sympathetic, which is kind of quite a trick to pull off. What have you find?
Well, it's a great way to end our LA themed podcast.
From the lavatory
to the public toilet.
Yes.
I think the only way we can really bow out from this is to hear Elliot Roberts talking about what cocaine did to LA. But before we go out with that, I'd just like to thank you, Chris, so much for coming and joining us.
Really great.
For a free-ranging and indeed very discursive conversation, mainly about Los Angeles. It's been really good to get your perspective. You are virtually a Californian now. I'll have to come and see you in Pioneer Town. I have actually been there.
Certainly the colour of a Californian.
He is a colour of a Californian. Yeah, no, I'll have to trek out to Joshua Tree again sometime soon. Yeah, I'd love to go up the mountain with you and pay homage to the late, great Ted Markland.
Do you see big spiders there?
No, big snakes.
No, snakes don't bother me. It's the spiders.
Okay, I haven't seen too many big. I've seen a tarantula.
Yes, well, that's
desert tarantula. So he'll come. But they're actually quite he'll friendly.
So thanks.
Great, from
both of us. It's been great talking with you, and we are going to go out, Mark, with this final clip of Elliot Roberts.
It's talking about the wonders of cocaine and what it did for
the drug that no one thought was addictive.
On that happy note, see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
No difference between the two. Cocaine all around my brain.
Johnny, you said that cocaine did more damage to the music scene in
I think it did.
Yeah.
It was the kind of thing where everyone was saying, wow, what a pure drug. Yeah. And no one can say anything bad about it. And no one was. It was the time no one knew anything.
Yeah.
And it was no one realized that it was totally addictive and that it ate your cells away and your nose fell off and your lips fell into the floor and your teeth fell out. And you killed your firstborn and butchered your wife. No one mentioned those things that I guess no one had taken it for a long period of time the way or embraced it as readily as everyone of that counterculture did. And you literally offered it from your accountant to your lawyer to the head of your record company. Yeah. We're all going, you know, want a bump?
Sure.
You know, it was like so mainstream and a lot of people we know were incredibly hurt by it.
Yes.
I mean, without question, some killed.
Sure.
Some their lives and careers were, you know, irreparably damaged and they could never get them back.
Yeah.
Mama, come here quick. That old cocaine about to make me sick. Cocaine running all around my brain.
That was Elliot Roberts in conversation with Barney Hoskins in 1993, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Chris Campion. His John Phillips book is in the works. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.